At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 231 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. This week's episode is sponsored by Sleep Number. Making New Year's resolutions is one thing. Sticking to them is another. Whether it's resolving to get to the gym more or eating sweets less, there's one thing that can help. Make sure you sleep well.
And you may not know, but it's recommended that we get 7 to 8 hours of sleep a night. And if that's you, awesome. But if you're getting less, science tells us and proves that getting more sleep can help you hold fast to your goals.
The Sleep Number bed lets you choose your ideal comfort and support on each side. It's really the perfect bed for couples.
And these beds are so smart, they can actually sense your movements. And as you move, they will automatically adjust. So no matter what your position, you can sleep comfortably throughout the night.
They even have an adjustment for snoring. Does your bed do that? Mine doesn't do that. I wish my bed did that. The adjustment I have currently for snoring is rolling over and going, babe, roll over. You're snoring, which he doesn't appreciate.
Don't miss the best bed for couples at the lowest prices of the season. Come in now and save $400 to $700 on the most popular Sleep Number mattresses.
You'll only find Sleep Number at sleepnumber.com or any of the 550 Sleep Number stores nationwide. And be sure to tell them that Outlander sent you. And now, on to our read-along. This week, we will be starting part two. Part two is entitled Past Imperfect, Chapter 3, The Minister's Cat.
Carrie R. writes, "The title of this chapter is The Minister's Cat. As the reader comes to find out, this is the name of a word game that Brianna and Roger play when they are trying to fill time during an otherwise mundane task, much like families play the alphabet game on long road trips, or used to play them anyway before the advent of DVD players and digital devices in the car."
No, we played way more than that. We played, what, Slug Bug? Every time you saw...
I mean, it may have been called that, but I just called it like Buggy or something like that.
Yeah, but that... And then the
I
license plate.
I Spy with My
game.
Little Eye license plate.
Yeah, I Spy. There are all kinds of games we played in the car. But is this the first time we encounter the Minister's Cat game in the series?
I think so, because apparently it didn't exist in the 18th century, or they didn't have time for that, the Scots. They had Culloden to worry about. And in France, they had Culloden to prevent. Plus, they're in France. I don't think a lot of French people know how to play that game, but at least in the 18th century. But the time that we do spend in the 20th century with Claire is very short. And even though she returns, it's still comparatively kind of short. It's Bree growing up. So I don't remember any scenes with Claire and Bree or Frank and Claire or Frank and Brie. So yeah, I think this is the first time.
So the only time that it could have happened is in Inverness with Brianna and Roger alone.
You're right. When they're going through papers or something.
Correct. That's the only time it could have happened if this is not the first. But I feel like this is the first time since they're literally calling the chapter The Minister's Cat.
The Minister's Cat is a Victorian era era parlor game in which the players start with the first letter of the alphabet and add an adjective that begins with the letter of the stem, the minister's cat. When a player can no longer provide an adjective that begins with the first letter of the alphabet, the play continues using the second letter, and so on. There are several variations of the game, including each player having to repeat all previous adjectives used by players before adding his or her own word to the list. Okay, sidebar, that's annoying.
Oh my God, could you imagine?
No, no, so stop right there. In this chapter, Roger tells Bree that it is a Scottish game. While none of the articles I read on this subject mentioned the game's origin, Diana Gabaldone is nothing if not an impeccable researcher of facts, so I will give Roger this one. Yeah, okay, so those are the end of Carrie's comments, but at this moment, but no, we don't know. I'm not doing that, no.
The minister's cat is an androgynous cat.
Roger calls, okay, chapter three begins officially. Roger calls Brianna in Boston. And he literally calls her Brianna. He calls her on the phone and he also uses the name Brianna. Apparently he miscalculates a bit, or did he? He's going to a conference in Boston and wants to know if she'd like to see him. Duh.
He totally did it on accident, not on purpose. I know, it's so easy to forget which way the time difference goes and how many hours it is and trying to understand. Like when we were in Scotland, you know, in 2015, and I was trying to call home to talk to my daughter, I was like always struggling. I'm like, what time is it back home? So I get it. I disagree.
I think you can forget how many hours it is. That's easy to forget. I don't think you forget which way it is. I mean, come on, it's either east or west.
But what does he gain by waking her up at God knows what time? Nobody knows.
Put it with a question mark. I didn't say he did it. I said, or did he?
I know, but if the or did he, what would he gain? What would he gain?
I don't have to answer that. There's no answer.
The only guarantee that she would be home and next to a phone? I mean, that's, I can't see what he would gain by lying, saying he didn't do it on purpose. Saying he did it on accident. That's all I'm saying.
Apparently, Mr. Roger, that's great. Mr. Rogers.
Ha. Who are the people in your neighborhood?
Not Bree. Apparently, he'd sent her a letter and she didn't answer. Bree, are you flipping mad?
She goes into that later.
She had a few things going on. Brianna says that she was, when he woke her up, she was dreaming of. Okay, now this may get into a conversation and we can go there. That's okay. But Brianna says she was dreaming of Frank when the phone rang. They were walking together in the woods and she couldn't keep up with him. We learn bits of what Frank would do with her. And no, don't get nasty. Frank also took her hiking in the mountains. So when she first says, I was hiking or I was in the mountains, she says, with my father. And she specifically says, but I couldn't see his face and I couldn't catch up to him. I can understand what he was saying, but I couldn't catch up and I couldn't see his face. So that is ambiguous, right?
Right.
But then she says that it reminded her of a time when she would hike with her dad or hike with Frank.
With her dad. No, but that's the thing. I thought perhaps she was thinking that she said that she thought she was hiking with her father, meaning her biological father. And then because she very specifically stated later that she used to do that with her dad.
Except that later on when she talks of the death of her father.
That the differential between the two was that when she said my father, that was, you know, her speaking of her biological father as opposed to her dad, which dad is a much more familiar term than just father.
When she talks, and it may not be in this chapter, but when she talks about when her mother left and she went through a bereavement that was similar to when her father died. Her father there is Frank. So I think there's enough up for discussion that it could be either ambiguous or Frank. I don't think you can make an argument for it being definitively Jamie, but I think you can make an argument for it being ambiguous or Frank.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
Okay. So,
it would have been way easier if she called Jamie her bio dad
or something. Yeah.
And like something very specifically Jamie.
Yo,
as opposed to
sperm donor.
Exactly. Yo, spunk dude.
Oh, Lord, that's coming out. So we learn what I said earlier was in semi support of it being Frank and not potentially Jamie. But I'm going to say this bit again, because now we're off of the discussion of whom she was dreaming of and back on to, well, this is truly Frank and only Frank and Frank and Bree. Now, we've gotten tidbits up until now, because of course the focus, Brianna was introduced in Dragonfly and Amber, but we have gotten tidbits of her relationship with Frank. And as the book series continues, we'll get more and more and more. And since we've already talked about it, I keep thinking, oh my gosh, can I mention it yet? Yes, we've already had Voyager. Okay, so in Voyager, if you remember I'm not going to say anything more than this, but the Brachan prophecy, the Brachan seer, oh, sorry, whatever prophecy that was, Fraser prophecy, whatever that was, but that was the Brachan seer. Okay, so I'm not going to connect anything right now. I'm just going to say that's something that may or may not die with Voyager. And similarly, if that can be said, we find out little bits of information. Yes, any father and daughter can enjoy a hike in the wilderness. There's nothing necessarily weird or unusual about that. But just file that away. Little by little by little, we get little glimpses of Brianna with Frank and some of the things that Frank did for her, did with her, or activities, whatever it was. And so I just wanted to make sure that I drew a line under this, because it could be nothing in the scheme of things, but at the end of this book, and certainly by the end of, you know, a book or two down the road, definitely at the end of this book, I think, you can look back and say, oh, that was something that, you know, maybe that you can see with different eyes, put it that way. Carrie R. writes, the way, and this is Summer, I think we'll appreciate this, the way this exchange is written, the father Brianna sees in her dream could just as easily have been Jamie as Frank. Bree had been told about her biological father to know what Jamie looked like. She could have recognized him not only by physical description, but also by intuitively knowing it was him. Without giving away too much, there is perhaps evidence that Bree may have second sight. According to Wikipedia, second sight is a form of extrasensory perception, the supposed power to perceive things that are not present to the senses, whereby a person perceives information in the form of a vision about future events before they happen, precognition, or about things or events at remote locations, remote viewing. And she provided a link, which we'll share in the show notes. If this is the case, then perhaps Bree is not so much reliving a memory of a shared experience with Frank, but a premonition or vision of a future event involving Jamie. Just as Jamie's ghost traveled to see Claire in the future, of course, we're talking about, I think it was chapter 1 or 2 in Outlander.
It was not the first chapter, but it was in the first section. Yeah, early
days. Okay, it was episode 1 of season 1. That's easier. Okay. Perhaps Bree has a similar ability to travel across time and space to the past to see, quote unquote, Jamie.
You know, if she does, she really does have the best of both worlds. She can travel physically and travel in dreams, which would make her the most amazing person in the show.
Well, we suspect she can travel. She hasn't traveled, but she can hear the stones. So we suspect she can travel. I thought it could be Jamie too. And this is back to Ginger. I thought that the person that she was walking with could be Jamie too. But a few paragraphs later, she mentions father and hiking in the mountains, and it's Frank. So it is the word father. So I think she was dreaming about Frank. But as I already said, I think it's either Frank or ambiguous. Bree is attuned to Roger's accent enough to know when he's in Scotland. I thought that was cute. And she tries to tell him why she didn't write, and he cuts her off and says not to worry, and at this point calls her Bree. Now, I don't know. I didn't go back, and I'm not going to go check. I'm curious, at least in this, because this is only chapter 3, at least in this book, this is the first time he's called her Bree. Up till now, it was Brianna. But I would have to go back and check Dragonfly and Voyager to see what that was. But you don't start off right away with the 3 syllables to cut it down to 1.
Especially if they haven't been answering your letters.
Oh, yeah.
You don't know where you stand with them. You're not going to go straight to the schmoopy. Schmoopy poo.
So why didn't Brianna write? While what happened with her mom and her going back, discovering Frank wasn't her father, etc., had nothing to do with Roger, he was inextricably linked to all of those things. Uncle Joe, of course, Joe Abernathy, also knew about the situation. Only Roger could hear the stones, too. Roger had wanted her to stay in Scotland after Claire left, but she couldn't. She had to finish her schooling, but she also had to get away to heal and rebuild a life. If she stayed, she believed there was no way she'd be able to forget what had happened, or at least even get through it. Her mom had given her into his care, into Roger's care. Here, he is a John, one of the stand-in for the beloved disciple, a blessed apostle type.
Okay, that's a totally different kind of John than I thought you were saying he was at first.
Summer.
And I'm like, wait, what?
You know. Oh, gosh. Roger is a beloved disciple type figure. And by that, I mean, in the Bible, Jesus on the cross gives the care of his mother into his beloved disciple, who is John. So here, Claire is giving care of her daughter into, it's not necessarily, Roger is not Claire's beloved, like not even romantically, but just like even like close friend, but she is transferring care to Roger. And he had cared for her, but what Brianna is not 100% sure of, and I think we can't really blame her, is was he caring for her, not just emotionally, but helping take care of her to keep his promise to Claire, or only because he truly cared for her?
Dude, like, this could have totally...
Summer's like, I don't care.
I don't. But that could have super backfired on Claire.
That's true.
Thinking, because... assuming that some dude is into your kid for reasons that are deeper than, hey, I got a hot kid, that could have completely backfired. What if he's just, I mean, he wasn't, thank goodness. But what if he was just a playboy who just wanted to get into her pants? And she's like, oh, take care of my daughter. I trust you. And then he walks away and he's like, sure. And then he just like messes with her brain and takes advantage of her and then walks away. So, I mean, that was I've never completely been able to count on Claire's sound judgment because she doesn't always have it. So it worked out in Brianna's favor with Roger not being a cad, but he totally could have been.
I thought you were going to say with Roger not being a cat. I was like, oh, that would be interesting.
You would have been way more into him if he was.
You shut your mouth.
You know I'm right.
So she couldn't see a future with Roger if it were rooted in obligation. Diana writes here that the events where Claire left and Brianna found out everything about her dad, or her not dad, her other dad, was last November. So currently it is June of 1969. And so last November means November of 1968. Claire went back to Jamie in Voyager. It was November 1968. Right now, when they're having this conversation, Brianna and Roger, it's June 1969. So when she'd come back from Scotland, Brianna had changed her course of study from history to engineering. Quote, solid, fact-bound, reassuringly immutable. Above all, controllable, unquote. Now, how much sense does this make? How much sense does this make? So here's someone she's lost her father through death, lost her mother, may as well be through death, and found out that the person who raised her was actually not her biological father. I mean, and that her mom, through some magical Mr. Mistopheles thing, walked back through time 200 years through stones she could hear, and Brianna could too. I mean, a normal human experience. You lose someone very beloved to you, you're going to be crushed. And then you find out your mom is like a fairy woman who like went back and got knocked up by a 200-year-old Highland fight. I mean, my point is it sounds like a fairy story. And so it's not just that she loses her dad. It's this thing. And Brianna is pretty, you know, pissy at first. I get it. In the book especially. But she comes around. Okay, fine. Great. But all this stuff, it would pull whatever her entire foundation. It was not shaken. It was destroyed. Utterly destroyed. Her world is gone.
But it was rebuilt.
But the rebuilding, my point is getting it rebuilt, the way she was able to do that, or part of her way to rebuild it, was getting away from Roger, because he was connected, even though it was not his fault. Getting away from Scotland and all the reminders, getting away from Roger, and changing her major to something that was, that the key word there is controllable. She had no control.
Well, it was not only controllable, but it distanced her from father who raised her, who, you know, had this lie that he lied to her for this whole time, right? So it distanced her from that. It distanced her from accidentally ever finding more information out about her bio dad, as is evidenced in the next chapter when everything goes awry at the Scottish Fair. And it allowed her to do something that was concrete and certain. And no matter how you do it, math is always math is always math. History is completely mutable. It is completely up to interpretation and is told by the winners. So I don't blame her even a little bit for that change.
Carrie R. writes, just as her mother becomes laser focused and turns to the logic of her scientific and medical training when her world spins out of control, Bree finds working with figures and logic in the face of the illogical to be comforting, and using her mind in such a way helps center her again. Michael M. writes, at the time I picked chapter 3, I did not remember its contents. I looked more at the due date than the chapter title. I was pleasantly surprised to find Roger and Bree, and not Stephen, insert expletive here, Bonnet. In these pages, the two are still at that awkward getting to know each other phase. Bree's hesitation is shown in her statement to Roger as if he were with her. Quote, go away so you can come back and do it right. Unquote. Carrie R. writes, the reader gets the impression that the two have not spoken much, if at all, since Bree's return to Boston after seeing her mother, Claire, go back through the stones at Crane Dunn a few months before. Now remember, it's not a few months, it's like 7 months. 8 months, whatever. I mean, I guess it's not a few, it's more than a few. Their conversation is awkward, sometimes stilted, and shot through with various apologies to each other. The attraction these two characters feel for each other is palpable throughout, but so is their hesitance to talk about their shared experience at the Stones several months before. As Brianna observes, quote, no one could pass through an experience like that and not be marked by it, unquote. While Uncle Joe, as Brianna calls Joe Abernathy, quote, knew the truth of her paternity, only Roger could truly understand what had happened. Only Roger could hear the Stones too. Unquote. Both Brianna and Roger are, for all intents and purposes, alone in the world. Neither one has parents or extended family members on whom to rely, nobody but each other with whom to process what has happened to them, and try to come to terms with their new reality now that includes time travel. Okay, Brianna is then at the airport, suddenly, quick, huge shift, to pick up Roger. And she's got her friend Gail with her. She brought her along so she wouldn't have any awkward silences. Gail was a talker. Roger appears. He's wearing a white shirt and scruffy jeans. Gail says, quote, he looks like a pirate, unquote. I never noted that line before. Carrie R. writes, in the concluding scenes of chapter 3, we meet Gail. Oh, Gail. Don't we all have an unfiltered nut job of a friend like Gail? It is actually quite nice to see that Brianna has at least one girlfriend who brings a little levity to her life. I've decided Gail is my spirit animal. Just like in the movies, they make eye contact, smile at each other, and she runs toward him. And he brought his guitar. And then he does Gail a solid and rolls all the R's at her. We find out he's going to play at a Celtic festival to make some money. His airfare was covered for his conference was covered, but the people who sent him wouldn't or couldn't cover the other expenses. He's also got his Bodren with him.
Am I the only one annoyed by Gail?
I mean, I don't know.
I'm annoyed by Gail for several reasons. I'm annoyed by Gail because she seems to be that friend who, even though her good friend is clearly into this dude, is still making passes at him.
I think she's just...
I'm sure she's oblivious and harmless, but...
I don't think she's oblivious, and I think she probably is harmless. I just think she's having fun.
I wouldn't care for that, personally.
As Brianna and Roger are driving to the Celtic Festival, they begin to play the minister's cat. They make their way, or start, to go through the alphabet. We learn that Bree hates tea. Just like she hates whiskey. This is after a week of him being there. So during that week, they saw each other briefly, it seems, every day. But this was the one whole day that they had together. Michael M. writes, "If you ask my daughters about my penchant for puns and alliteration, they will roll their eyes. After learning what a coccygodynia is, Roger replies with, quote, the minister's cat is a cumstery cat, and follows up with a great alliteration. Quarrelsome coccygodynians are camstery by nature. One of the things I like about the minister's cat is how it lets Roger and Bree share their thoughts and feelings." That's true. I think it's actually a really good game to express yourself without expressing yourself, or at least express yourself with the guise of putting it on something else. And so I can see how that can definitely release some tension. You ever played it some?
I tried to play it with you earlier and you totally shut me down.
Besides that, dork.
I can't believe that you're going to just totally let that go by and not call Michael M. on being, into dad jokes.
Into dad jokes?
Oh, God, yeah. You know dad jokes.
Oh, like our dad.
Like all dads. All dads tell the same jokes. It's. I'm pretty sure they all go to school for it. And there's a class when all the women go and learn how to give birth to babies, the men all go into classes to learn how to tell dad jokes.
Well, see, I could let it pass. I didn't have to worry about it. I knew you'd pick it up. So finally, Brianna tells him the problem about her just how she was feeling, basically.
She tried to tell him lots of times and he kept shutting her down. You don't have to, but it's not about
on the phone. Yeah. But now she's going to tell him in the car. He tells her that he has not been back to the Stones since they were all there together. She explains that when she's around him, it all comes back. And she also says that she had a crush on him, but wasn't sure if he was being nice out of obligation or if they really cared. And how does he answer? He kisses her.
That was super dangerous, by the way.
I agree.
Because they're on windy mountain roads from what I remember, and him saying, are you going to ram into the car in front of me if I kiss you? I was like, just tell her to pull over. Tell her to pull over. If it's something that you're actually concerned about, just tell her to pull over for a hot minute. I promise you, she would have pulled over. I mean, she ran and basically made out with him at the airport in front of her friend.
Yeah.
She's gonna kiss you in the car.
Just don't get yourselves killed.
Right. Thank you. We will now be moving on to chapter 4, entitled A Blast from the Past.
Erica B. writes, the title makes me wonder what sort of people or memories are going to come to play in this chapter. Now, as Roger is changing for his performance, we find out that he has an envelope for Brianna. He's debating giving it to her.
Give it to her. Always give it to her.
They'd entered the festival and seen the 78th Fraser Highlanders pipe band from Canada. And they saw the Fraser and the clan saying and everything. And Brianna had she didn't have a stroke, but she was affected. And so she's just wondering, should I give this to her? Because she's not doing so wonderful.
I just want to know if she found the Fraser clan tent and saw all of the Outlander books.
Oh, Lord.
Because if you go to any Highland Games, you will find the Fraser tent with all the Outlander books.
Well, that's since the 90s anyway, or 2000s. But this is in the 60s.
Oh, you're right. This is the 60s. We're good. Never mind.
Erica B. writes, poor Roger has all this self-doubt with his feelings for Bree. He's so worried that the Highland Games will be upsetting for her. But I think also that he hopes it will help her embrace her heritage. Now, Summer, I never caught that Roger was, or he didn't wear it here, but I never caught the fact that Roger was keen on wearing his family's underwear under the kilt. Quote, the ancient olive drab drawers were military issue, circa World War II, one of Roger's few mementos of his father. He didn't bother with the pants much in the normal course, but included these with his kilt sometimes as a defensive measure against the amazing boldness of some female spectators, unquote. But he decided not to wear them this day. Quote, off stage, he'd have Brianna with him if she should choose to take any liberties of her own, .. unquote.
No, I totally missed that.
And as he leaves the Umkleidekabine, which is the changing room,
says, was not in the book.
No, that's inside Ginger.
Oh my God.
In my head.
I was like, no. I knew exactly what you were saying, but I'm like, that was not in the book. We don't have that version.
As he, we don't have that version. As he leaves the Umkleidekabine, he says, "Wish me luck, Dad," and goes to find Brianna. So he goes and finds her, and when he hugs her, we find out through him, through his nose, that her hair smells clean, like fresh grass. And that is not necessarily a foreshadowing, but we find out what she has a scent. And I had not going to lie, as I was writing this down, I was like, wait, am I mixing up a discovery of witches? Where everybody has a scent. As they grab a bite to eat and chat with one of the food vendors, we find out that Brianna in no way plans to take liberties with him, referring to when the food vendor said, quote, "I'll bet everything under there is in perfect operating condition," unquote. She says, "If he says it now, I'll drive off and leave him marooned on this mountain."
It wasn't if he says everything's in perfect working condition. It's if he says, "Give me your hand and I'll show you."
Yes.
In response to what does the Scotsman wear under his kilt,
which she was not gonna ask.
Officially the worst question ever, that, and I know that we've all, as Outlander fans, heard it for the last 4 years, asked of all of the actors anytime they're interviewed for the first time by a new outlet.
She says, quote, "If he says it now, I'll drive off and leave him marooned on this mountain. He can stay here and eat octopus for all I care," end quote.
Gross. You know, I've been to a lot of Highland Games and I've never seen octopus.
That's not the point. I've seen a lot of gross stuff.
Oh, for sure. But it's usually, there's usually an attempt at keeping it regional. I mean, there's always a corn dog dude. I'm not going to lie about that. There's always somebody selling corn dogs and lemonade, and there's an ice cream one. But they, I mean, there's always, for the most part, it seems like it's, I mean, yeah, French fries. Okay. I can think of other things that are.
What did I have the last like 3 games? Nachos.
That's a personal preference, but.
But it could, I couldn't have the preference if it weren't there.
I guess, but I'm just saying, I've never seen octopus on a stick.
Or Chinese food.
Or
I think I've seen a teriyaki truck somewhere. I've seen a teriyaki. I have.
Okay.
Erica B. writes, "I have been to several Highland Games, and even ones in New Hampshire, where I am sure this one is supposedly located. This bit about ethnic food I find weird. My experience is that there are one or two Scottish food trucks, and then some that are more traditional American fare. To have all of this other ethnic food, ethnic fare seems weird, even if it's the result of the specific location." So Roger explains that he went with Mackenzie for the tartan, etc., because it was also his own family name, actually more of his own family name. His baptismal name is Roger Jeremiah Mackenzie. Now, they talk about his lineage and how one of Roger's ancestors had been married 6 times, but only had children by one of the husbands. And Brianna says, in this conversation, she says, quote, "Once is enough to get pregnant," unquote. Erica B. writes, "On my first read-through, I missed or didn't retain the information that it is an old family name."
Well, it's not just that it only takes once. It was the fact that she was saying this ancestor who had been married several times but only had children with Roger's particular ancestor, the one who made Roger's family line happen, was that he's the only one I slept with every night. And as opposed to the others, which she was, you know, sporadically slept with. So, and that's why she said, well, it only takes one time, regardless of, well, he's the only one I slept with every night. And then she says, well, that's not what my mom said. My mom taught in all of our classes that it only takes one time.
And the reason I highlighted that is because of the wonderful things she does. And as they walk back, Roger feels a stirring beneath his kilt several times, actually. Now, they chat about health class, sex ed, etc., and he tells her that, yes, he has, but no, he isn't. And he isn't seeing anyone serious. And same with her. Erica B. writes, "These two are such romantics. And I think seeing how they fell in love is such a delight compared to Claire and Jamie, whose courting didn't really happen before they got married." So Roger decides to give Brianna the envelope.
I wish he hadn't.
It was I know. It's kind of iffy. It was photographs. So she's listening to him perform and she's trying hard, like, do I open it? Do I not open it? She finally, like, I got to open it. So she does. Now she's listening to the music, and during the song Johnny Cope, she feels really kind of otherworldly. Now that's completely my word. But it's almost like she's outside of herself. And she realizes that both of her parents had been there at this battle that the song is about. Her father had charged at Preston. Diana explains the difference between Roger and Bree. And this is the biggest difference between them at this point. Quote, some people tried to preserve the past, others to escape it. And so him being a historian is completely in line with preserving the past. Her changing her major, her being an engineering major does not say you're trying to escape anything, but her changing from history to engineering and the reasons therefore are completely an escape.
Oh, for sure.
And then he begins to play the bodhran. Now, near the end of the song, she pulls out the photos and they're of Frank and Claire, young and happy. And it's very, I can just imagine her looking at these during this song. I couldn't imagine. Oy vey. So as she's listening to the songs, evoking the battles of the Scots and the 45, where her birth parents had been, she's looking at pictures of the mother and father who raised her. She is looking through them and realizes that these are pictures from their wedding day. The reception had been at the manse. And looking at her parents' faces, especially her mother's, she is about to lose it. She rushes out of the performance before anyone can see her in tears. Joe B. writes, there's inner conflict for Bree as she looks at the pictures Roger gave her. She is looking at the history of Frank whilst hearing Roger sing of Jamie's. She may be able to distance herself from other songs, but she has had a firsthand account of how Johnny Cope came to be walking after his defeat at Prestonpans from her mother. And despite the truth in the pictures of Claire and Frank's wedding day, Bree knows that the true love her mother longed to meet on the Bonnie Bonnie Banks wasn't the man she called Daddy. Later that evening, there's the calling of the clans. Roger startles her as he yells, "To the gorge!" And as he goes to change, he tells her, just in case, the Fraser's cry is Castel Juni, which I can't pronounce. As she's there waiting, the Frasers are called. She has a moment, and she's holding onto her bag for dear life, of course, with the photos. So now, Summer, describe that moment.
The panic attack?
Yeah.
That's what she had. She had a straight-up panic attack. Like, I feel like everything stopped moving, and she had this fear that everyone in the entire place was turning and looking at her and waiting to see what she would do, when in fact, nobody was remotely even aware of her existence with regards to her Fraserness. But in that moment for her, she was having a complete, like, crisis of, you know, existential crisis.
Erica B. writes, the panic hits her, though, in the calling of the clans at the end of the day. I think her sense of self is in question, and it's really upsetting to her, and rightly so. Roger, I think, truly wants her to have pride in her true self and from which she comes. I completely understand this, but I think that perhaps this event was a bit too much. Also, perhaps it was the kick in the butt she needed for her own sake in finding happiness in the truth. At the end of the chapter, Diana writes, quote, how could she thought. And then, seeing Roger come into the light, fire on his head. Think of Jamie coming out as the sun, y'all. And she thought again, how could she help it? Marlene W. writes, Roger surveys the crowd at the Highland Games and muses that while it is anything but authentic to the reality of pre-Culloden clan life, no octopus on a stick back then, the games represent, quote, an example of the Scots' age-old talent for survival, the ability to adapt to anything and make a profit from it, unquote. At the same time, Jamie and Claire, back in 1766, are doing just that, adapting to their new circumstances in the new world and looking for ways to profit from it. Both the Highland Games and the American colonies represent optimism, as did the 1960s era, with its emphasis on brave new worlds and final frontiers, to borrow a phrase from Star Trek, which ran from 1966 to 1969. Joe B. writes, "The political power of the clans may be gone. Their rivalries and clashes moved into a sporting arena rather than a battlefield, and identities merging as Scots found themselves integrated into new British colonies, America, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. But their strength is still in their power to encompass and connect their members, even now." Roger recognizes this in his use of Mackenzie as a stage name, and can yell "Tu le charge" with the best of them, despite a career at the bastion of the English establishment, Oxford. Even Bree, who doesn't want to be part of this, is affected by it, acknowledging a rush of adrenaline at the call to the Frasers, feeling the echo in the bone. In the face of this inescapable response, Bree has a new understanding of Claire. As a grieving daughter, she wonders how Claire could abandon Frank. But now she can feel for Claire as a woman who can't fight the pull of her heart. Bree acknowledges how could she help it is a step to greater understanding and greater forgiveness. Joe B. also writes, "This chapter, or book, has themes of reinvention, identity, and integration. At the festival, Bree encounters an expression of Scottish culture in a new way. One with more depth and meaning. Meeting Frasers abroad is confronting. It's one thing to accept and believe her mother's story, but another to accept that for yourself and have it change your identity. As Bree sees the resplendent formality of her father's past, humorously, Roger does the same through his father's underwear, herself at her comic relief best. And the age-old what's under a Scotsman kilt gag gets reworked and leads us to the wonderfully vivid vignette of Claire take Bree's sex ed class. And how embarrassing would that be? Bree is struck dumb at the sight of Roger in a kilt, reminiscent of Claire's beautiful description of seeing Jamie dress for their wedding. Quote, a tall, straight-bodied, and by no means ill-favored young Highlander at close range is breathtaking. How and what her feelings are of Roger and what they mean now in the face of the reality of life after the thrill of the chase remain to be explored. This chapter also raises the question of what is Scotland now, used here as a metaphor for our characters, as relevant in 1969 as 1767, and now in many ways. Where does authenticity meet with the need to adapt and survive? Ironically, I started my notes for this chapter at a Celtic festival here in Australia, wondering the same thing. Much of what a wider common view of what Scottish culture is arguably attributable to Walter Scott stage managing a visit to Edinburgh of King George IV, the first reigning monarch to visit Scotland in 200 years, and the rage for all things Scottish started by Queen Victoria in the 1840s, than to any strong sense of returning to a true roots of culture. Perhaps it was an expression of something of the past that could be integrated into an expanding world after the bans on language, dress, and music were lifted. Whilst it is romantic and idealized, it's also a chance for reimagining and reestablishing a new way of being, of taking the best parts of the past to make new futures in new worlds.
And that was chapter 4. This is chapter 5, entitled 200 Years from Yesterday.
So Brianna and Roger are at a gathering at Joe Abernathy's to watch the moon landing. Brianna introduces Roger to Joe. He asks her to go look at the TV and to fix it. Ultimately, Joe goes to have the father-boyfriend conversation with Roger. They, of course, have a whiskey, and it just happens to be a Lagavulin, a gift from Claire.
Have you tried Lagavulin?
I'm sure somewhere.
I don't remember if I have or not. I thought you might. Never mind. Go on.
I don't remember how it tasted. I don't think I liked it. Roger wonders just how much Claire had told Joe. Joe, of course, is standing in for Frank and asking questions along the line of what are his intentions. And Roger says he's strictly they are strictly honorable. Joe's asking because he called Brianna the night before a number of times and she hadn't answered. He's, of course, understandably protective of her. Roger says that he wouldn't take advantage. He says he wouldn't take advantage. Eileen P. writes, Bree does go to MIT, so naturally she carries a Swiss Army knife in her pocket. Always prepared. Do you think Joe pulled the TV plug out of the outlet? It surely gave him time to interrogate Roger as Bree fixed the TV. I would not put it past him, Eileen. What do you think, Sam?
I wouldn't, but I don't think he did. Nobody leaves themselves open. That's like computer 101. The first thing you do is reboot it. You know what I mean? Or check to make sure it's plugged in. I can't imagine that, because anyone else, like literally in a room full of engineers, regardless of whether or not they're electrical engineers and or mechanical engineers or whatever kind of engineers, they are all in that room because there was a bunch of them. For not a single one of them to have looked to see if it was plugged into the wall seems very hard for me to swallow.
But it's also the easiest thing for Joe to do and not ruin his TV and still have a moment with Roger.
I mean, for sure, but he could have had a moment with Roger regardless if the TV wasn't working. He could have found something else.
I don't know. They were all over each other. So I don't know.
I think he could have found something else.
So on TV, if they finally get it to work, there's a countdown to the landing. Joe says, quote, "Mind me, Mr. Wakefield. I don't ever want to hear that you've made that girl unhappy. Ever." Unquote. At this point, we don't know if they've consummated their anything, but Joe watches the two of them watch each other. And then he says to Roger, "Oh, it's like that, is it?" And Roger replies, "Yeah, like that."
Roger made it pretty clear that that's not the nature of their current relationship.
There were no words made, that words said. That's all I'm saying.
There were no words when he said that he put Brianna in his bed and slept himself on the floor?
No, he didn't say that. We discover what happened later on, but that's in his thoughts. He does not say that to Joe. Then in resignation, Joe says, quote, "Claire did say she liked you. Okay. Slange." Unquote. Eileen P. writes, as part of his interrogation method, Joe decides to ply Roger with alcohol. Well, a lot of times it works, or at least makes people feel comfortable.
It depends on the outcome you're looking for, but it can be helpful.
So between the Celtic festival and this night, they've gotten really comfortable with each other. He kisses her neck in public, pulls her against them, and whispers to her, "You've got the roundest arse in the world." The reason? So the reason that they're getting so schmuggly-muggly is because he has 2 hours before he leaves the country. They knew that nothing was going to happen in 2 hours, let alone in front of anybody at a party, even though it was dark. The night before, though, this is what I don't understand. So we find out the night before, however, so we're trying to make a comparison between this night when there nothing's going to happen, nothing really, and the last night, quote, they had known they were playing with dynamite and had been more cautious. He wondered if Abernathy would actually have punched him had he admitted that Brianna had spent the night in his bed, unquote. Now, we find out later on, in his bed does not mean they consummate anything. We get it. But what we don't know, well, he says, and I'll describe it later on, that she's tired. He brings her up to his bed, lays her down, covers her up, and then he goes and sits on the floor. That's what we hear. But then what is this, Summer? What is this? They had known they were playing with dynamite the night before and had been more cautious. What? That, to me, that meant that they fooled around but didn't do it. But if he slept on the floor and she was in the bed, I can't marry those two statements.
They didn't fool around that hard. If she fell asleep in the bed before anything happened and he slept on the floor.
Exactly. That's what I'm trying to say. So if they knew they were playing with dynamite the night before, it doesn't seem like it. They weren't too careful if someone's asleep.
I feel like they did know it because of everything leading up to the Scottish Games. And I think that because maybe they both knew, quote unquote, both knew that they were playing with dynamite, that they weren't aggressively, that they were maybe purposefully tempering themselves against it.
By playing with dynamite, you mean a very something that if and when they got actually truly physical, that it would just, that they could would not be able to stop themselves.
That's what I think.
Okay, that I can go with that. Yes, we learned the truth. She'd slept on the bed and he was on the floor. So we're brought back to the party. The first man walks on the moon. It's a magical moment they witnessed together. And it's not the first. It was a different century, Diana writes, 200 years from yesterday. From singing about the 45 to watching a man walk on the moon. Roger, was someone who looked back. She looked forward. Did they have a future? And then Diana goes and makes me hate her even more. Quote, she turned in his arms to kiss him hard and cling to him, And he thought perhaps it didn't matter that they faced in opposite directions, so long as they faced each other. Unquote.
Woo! Y'all.
I know. Marlene W. writes, the theme of chapters 4 and 5 is discovering new worlds. Claire and Jamie, in the preceding chapters, are learning to find their way in their new world, the colonies. Brianna and Roger are also making a beachhead, as are the Apollo 11 astronauts, and by extension, all mankind, who are stepping on the moon for the very first time. Bree's visit to the Highland Games is a small step into the world of her father, Jamie, and together, Bree and Roger are taking a giant leap. A new romantic relationship, which is in itself a whole new world. A whole new world! Bree and Roger watching the moon landing harkens back to chapter 42 of Voyager, when Claire and Jamie aboard the Artemis look into the night sky and speculate whether Brianna will ever walk on the moon in the future.
Spoiler alert, she won't.
At that time, Jamie wondered if Brianna would have a husband to care for her. When Bree is looking at the moon via the news broadcast on TV, she is in the arms of a man who cares for her very much. Or as Uncle Joe observes, like that, is it? Joe B. writes, if Chapter 4 is Scotland reimagined, Chapter 5 is America at the best of its post-war ambition. Bree's comfort zone is reestablished after the challenges of the day before. Here she is American, engineer, and in the company of friends. Back in Voyager, another mention of the moon chapter. Chapter 42, The Man in the Moon. Jamie and Claire watched the moon discussing Bree and marriage. In 1969, her loco parentis, Joe Abernathy, takes his role seriously and whilst waiting for the broadcast, takes the opportunity to grill Roger. Equally fitting is Roger holding up under this gentle but firm interrogation. It seems Mackenzie blood will tell in a battle of wills. And I love the image of two people as conspicuous as Roger and Bree sneaking up to a hotel room to continue the facade of morality. Roger and Bree show easy physical and emotional connections, as do Jamie and Claire in their viewing of the moon, but here constrained by the imminent departure of Roger. They can and will only go so far, both still aware of the many things unresolved. As Roger sees Bree in her space, he is aware of her Americanness, that confidence and certainty contrasting with his Britishness. He is the outlander here. And it makes him question his place with Bree. That Bree kisses Roger at one of the defining moments of the 20th century reassures him that in this most American moment, she turns to him, gives him confidence of his heart that even though they come from opposite directions, they will look at each other first. And finally, Eileen P. writes, what's with Gail? She keeps flirting with her BFF's man. Bree should rethink this friendship. Then there was a comment about the Scott not having anything to protest about. I'm pretty sure Gail did not go to Harvard or MIT. And then she says, does one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind refer to the moonwalk or progress in Bree and Roger's relationship? Quote, it was a different century, 200 years from yesterday, unquote. Progress in leaps and bounds.
And that was chapter 5 and the end of part 2. Join us next week when we begin part 3 entitled Pirates.
So, if you would like to continue the conversation, we always welcome you to join our Facebook community, and that can be found at outlanderpod.com/group. And if you would like to participate in a future chapter discussion of our read-along of Drums of Autumn, book 4 in the Outlander series, you can find out more information and dates and how to become involved by going to outlanderpod.com/DOA. And of course, DOA is the initials. DOA are the initials for Drums of Autumn. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook. facebook.com/OutlanderPod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @OutlanderPod.